Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, send me an email. I would love to hear from you. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. I want to say thank you to all the listeners, close to 500,000 downloads of the podcast. Wow. Thank you so much for your support. I hope you've enjoyed all the shows from the musicians. I hope you learned about health issues from the doctors. And I just hope you had a good time sharing with friends and family. But again, thank you for your support. Today, wow, an amazing story we'll be discussing. It's a fictional book, but it's based on reality of the Rwandan genocide and a young man who's a runner. The author's name is Naomi Benaron, and she's a fiction writer and poet. This is not her first writing. She wrote a short story collection called Love Letters from a Fat Man. The book, Running the Risk, is a winner of the Bellwether Prize of Fiction. But you'd be surprised to know that Naomi is also a marathoner, triathlete, and before then, she was a geophysicist and seismologist, so she has a lot of hats she's worn. Good morning, Naomi.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Wow. As I mentioned to you before we started the show, intense. Like, I wanted to read it. I was like, oh, God, here we go. I already know the story. Like, what is she going to tell me about the Rwandan genocide and this guy and his family and running? Like, oh, I want to, but I don't want to. And then I started it, and it was like, start, stop. Where's the tissue? Oh, happiness. Oh, sadness. It was just a roller coaster of a ride.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you found the sadness in it. I mean, not the sadness. I'm glad you found the happiness in it, because even though it is a really sad story, what came to me more and more as I researched the book was the happiness of the people and the joy that they shared with family, the joy that came to them, just the simple things like cooking meals. They have the most amazing food. It's so good. And when they eat, you can just watch how people enjoy every bite, and you enjoy every bite with them. And that's really what I wanted to convey more and more as I got to know the people and got to spend time in their country and in their houses.
Let's start at the beginning, the title, Running the Rift. What does that mean? Why don't you explain to the audience what that means?
I've been a geologist and a geophysicist for years, and I'm still a geologist and geophysicist in my heart, although I don't think I could solve the differential equations anymore. But the metaphors of geology have always meant so much to me. I love to be able to look at rocks and think, this is what happened to the world. This is what happened, historically to make these rocks. You know, continents were colliding or volcanoes were going off, and there's so much turmoil and rocks heaving and exploding, and I love that. And so the rift is, in one sense, from a geological sense, it's the Albertine Rift, which runs across East Africa, and it's a zone where literally the continent of Africa is splitting apart. It's heating up and it's thinning, and someday there may be a sea there. So metaphorically, when you think of Rwanda, where the country was torn apart by this violence between two people who really were the same people, the Hutu and the Tutsis. So you have the rift, the political rift and the geological rift.
Geological rift. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's just tell the audience a little bit. Some people may not be familiar with what happened in Rwanda, but more than estimated 800,000 people killed in Rwanda starting 1994, actually even before then, starting the 1950s, there were rebellions. And the fight was between the Hutu people and the Tutsis, and mainly it came out of an argument that the Tutsis were in power for a long time and the Hutus were the minority, and they rebelled. But one of the things that you also bring up is how it was orchestrated, a political orchestration. Why don't you explain what that means to the audience?
Okay. I'll try to give you the really short version of that.
Yeah, we can't do that.
But initially, the Belgians colonized the area of Rwanda and Burundi in 1916 following the First World War. And before the Belgians came, really the Hutu and Tutsi were one people. You know, they have the same language, they have the same clan system, they have the same origin myths, the same religion, you know, they had the same animist religion before the Belgians came and brought Christianity. So, theoretically, what people say, and this may or may not be true, that the Tutsi were initially a Nilotic people that came down, and there's evidence that a Nilotic people did come down through Tanzania and settled in the area of Burundi and Rwanda. And it was the Belgians who separated Burundi and Rwanda into two countries. Before that, it was just one region. And the Tutsi were the keeper of the cattle. They were a taller people, a lighter people, you know, thinner boned. And what happened in the area was that Tutsi became a class distinction. The elite were the Tutsi. The Mwami, the king, was Tutsi, and the court was Tutsi. So the richer people, the ruling people, were Tutsi. The Hutu were, in general speaking, a darker people. They were stocky, you know, stronger people. They did the farming. So the question is, did it evolve that the stronger people did the farming and became Hutu? Or, you know, were they initially two tribes? And we don't really know. But,
and the thing is, the question is that the problem is that if you're walking down the street, you're not going to know the difference. You know,
exactly.
It's like for me as an American, I don't know the difference between, say, sometimes I can tell. I grew up as a Buddhist, so I grew up around Japanese people. So if somebody starts speaking, I will know that they're speaking Japanese, maybe Chinese, maybe Korean. But if
right.
I see their face, I'm not necessarily going to know you're Korean, you're Japanese, you're, you know, from you're Thai. Maybe if you're Cambodian, darker complexion, something like that. But the same goes for what's happening, you know, in Bosnia or Darfur, these different areas
mm-hmm.
that we as Americans can't understand because to us they look the same. Even
right.
though
and, yeah.
it's
even
tribal,
in Rwanda,
difference.
Yeah. Even in Rwanda, people couldn't really tell the difference a lot of times. I mean, there are certain people. You can't really point a finger at someone and say, they're Hutu. But
right.
there are these really tall, beautiful, you know, very, very thin-featured people. And you can look at them and say, that's a Tutsi. And
mm-hmm.
maybe 85% of the time you'll be right. But there's been so much intermarriage, so much mixture, that it is really difficult. And what they did, the genocide was in 1994, and what happened was the Belgians, when they colonized, they believed in divide and conquer. They were King Leopold was the king of Belgium. He was not a very nice man. And
yeah.
so he instigated this policy of identification cards. He set up the Tutsi as the kind of the overseers, you know, the
right.
rulers. And mm-hmm. they actually measured people's noses. And they would write down, they had identity cards. And before, where you could change, you could marry a Tutsi and become Tutsi, you could get so many cattle and become Tutsi. But the Belgians instigated this, these identity cards in Ndangamutu in Kinyarwanda. And once they put in those cards what your ethnicity was, Hutu or Tutsi, you could not change. And in 1994, during the genocide, they set up roadblocks all over the country, and they would ask for your identity card. And if your identity card said Tutsi, you did not make it alive to the other side of the roadblock.
The crazy part is I have a daughter, and she went off to college just recently this year, and she said, Mom, you know, she's saddened by how stupid the world is. She says the more and more she learns about the world, she gets mad at how stupid people are. And what she meant was that if you know history, you realize that these actions are not new. These scenarios, these scenes are not new of dividing and conquering, of labeling
mm-hmm.
people this or that, of, you know, I'll give you, you know, the 100 acres over here if you control the other people over there. And what the problem is that people are ignorant to the history of the global history, in a sense. Because if you knew the global history, you would say, wait a second, they were just doing that over here on the left, and then over here on the right. Now they're trying to do it over here in the middle. you know, this is like really stupid. We're being used. We're being, you know, manipulated. And neither one of us are going to win. You know, so that's the sad part, you know, about these types of incidents, the genocide. Let's talk about some happy stuff in the book, because there's a lot of wonderful, happy moments in the book. I love, like you said, about the family and the moments that they had and how they enjoyed that. Also how they shared with their neighbors before these incidents came about. People, you know, some people, like, for example, the main character's father really taught him that we're all Rwandans. You know, I thought that was a beautiful story. Also, the friendship between men. Now, I don't know if people mention that to you a lot, but, you know, in America, there's this, you know, oh, my God, we can't touch us guys. Oh, I'll give you a little guy hug, but, like, pat. But the friend Jean-Patrick had Daniel, his name.
Uh-huh.
That was so beautiful. It was like a love story of two guys, but it was a heterosexual love story. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was, I mean, where did you see that, or do you know guys who interact like that? How did you come up with that? I thought it was beautiful.
You know, that's the interesting thing. You know, when you go to Rwanda, you see guys holding hands all the time, and you see women holding hands with each other. But the taboo in Rwanda is men and women holding hands in public or with their arms around each other in public.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that, and it's really, you know, now it's becoming less strict because, you know, they're kind of, they see what goes on in the movies and in Western culture, so it's becoming less strict. But really, you did not see I've noticed the difference. I first started going to Rwanda in 2002, and I never saw a man and a woman hold hands, and it was really no. But you see, and what was especially touching to me, you know, because here women can hold hands. Although I've walked down the street with my sister, like, and we've had our arms around each other and gotten really dirty looks. But in Rwanda, it's just so wonderful to see two guys walking down the street holding hands. It's just such an open and beautiful display of affection. So that's what I wanted to get across with Daniel. And yes, you're right.
Well,
I mean, they loved each other.
Yeah, they loved each other. And it was unabashed, and it was just love, you know. So that was a really beautiful moment. Let me just read a little part here. This is early on in the book. This is chapter 8. And it says, this is the coach and Jean-Patrick having a conversation. I thought I'd find you here, the coach said. Play to win, his football jersey proclaimed. He handed Jean-Patrick a pair of green Nikes. What are these for? They felt light as air in Jean-Patrick's hands. Try them. Jean-Patrick slid a foot into the sneaker. His body tingled. When his toes hit something hard, he tried to force them in. The coach laughed. I forgot, there are socks inside. The socks were thin and soft, and with them on, Jean-Patrick's feet slipped into the shoes as if gliding through butter. He took a few prancing steps. The soles were springy. He almost lifted from the ground with his toe off. The sides held his heels like a firm hand. I don't need to go on, but basically the story is about the main character, Jean-Patrick, and him running for his freedom, running for his life, running for his family, running for his country. There's so many, you know, running to help clear his mind. You were a runner. You said you're also a triathlete in your bio. How many triathlons have you run?
I couldn't count them. A lot.
Oh, so many.
Yeah. I can count the marathons. I've run 10 marathons.
Wow. So did that help you definitely in writing? Because you talk about his breathing, you talk about his cramping, you talk about different exercises he did, using his belly, the pacing, all these things. Did you know these things, or did you also have to kind of do a little digging and talk to people about these different skills and training?
Well, you know, I made Jean-Patrick a runner because, you know, I was writing about someone from a culture that when I started writing, and how many times did I say to myself, are you completely insane? What are you doing? I knew that about the culture. You know, I've written from a male perspective before. That wasn't really that much of a challenge. But I need to, when I write, I really need to be able to get inside the heart and the soul of a character in order to create the character and set that character free on the page. So because I'm a scientist and because I run, bike, and swim, but running was my first love. I ran way before I discovered triathlon when I was injured and couldn't run, so I started swimming. But my love for running, and I do my best writing when I'm running, and I've done a lot of training, I've had a lot of coaches, so all that stuff came from me, and it was a way for me to get into Jean-Patrick, because that transcends culture. Anyone from any culture is going to train and is going to have those kind of experiences and those kind of revelations, like, oh, if I run from my core, I am so much stronger. And then, of course, you always have your coaches who are helping you, and, you know, they're going to say, it doesn't matter if you're from Rwanda or Egypt or the United States, your coaches are going to tell you the same kinds of things. So, but then there were some specific events that I did steal. I'm also a massage therapist, which that's how I make my living now, although now I'm beginning to be able to support myself more as a writer. But I love massage therapy. And one of my massage, in fact, one of the main inspirations for this book was my massage patient, Patrick Nduimana, who's from Burundi, and he ran the 800. That's why I chose the 800. I personally hate the 800. But, I had a coach who always made me run 800s, and I hated them more than anything. But so I had this massage patient, and he was the one who really taught me, at least in theory, to love the 800. And then I got a lot of specific kind of training things, you know, like different workouts from him.
Yeah, from him. Okay. Now, tell me, you initially went to Rwanda in 2002. Can you teach us a little of the language today, maybe? How do you say hello in the language you, is Kinyarwanda?
Kinyarwanda,
So how
Muraho.
Do you say hello?
Muraho, Amakuru. Amakuru is what's new. Muraho
okay.
is hello. And Amakuru is what's new.
Amakuru
and then
is what's new?
Amakuru is what's your news.
Mm-hmm.
And then you usually, if things are good, you respond, Nimeza.
Nineza.
Which means my news is good.
Oh, that's good. I don't want to have bad news.
No. We'll keep everything good.
And how do you say goodbye?
Murabeho.
Murabeho?
Well, there's like a million different words.
Different
murabeho
way, yeah.
is goodbye. Yeah. Murabeho is goodbye. If you're not going to see someone for a while, you say murabeho, goodbye. Or if it's evening, you can say mwiriwe, which means good evening, or ijoro zizo, which means good night, or murumucheho.
That's a tough one, ijoro zizo. That's
ijoro,
a tough
yeah.
one.
I know. And the thing
wow.
is, like, that there's like 16 different classes of nouns, and the descriptive word, like good, like you can have riza, chiza, Muiza, Neza, it all depends on which of these 16 classes. Yeah, so it's really
yeah.
complicated. And I can't,
wow.
I'm not anywhere near fluent. I have to have my friends help me a lot.
So tell me about some of the friends that helped you. You mentioned three people near the end of the book who worked with you. Just talk to the audience a little bit about how you developed the relationship with these three people.
Well, when I was very first researching the book, I started, you know, as one does now, instead of going to the library, I hate to admit it, but I Googled, and I got the name of this professor of linguistics, and his name was Alexandre Kimeni, and I didn't have any idea at the time how incredibly famous this person was in Rwanda. As it turned out, he was considered for the presidency after the genocide, and that's a whole other story. But I just got his name, always a professor of linguistics. So I wrote to him and explained a little bit of my project, and he emailed me back instantly. And he said, whatever I can do to help you, I'm here to help you. And as it turned out, he was having a conference. He lived in Sacramento, and he was married to another professor, Mathilde Mukantabana, who is another, the other, I dedicate the book to Mathilde and Kimeni. And
one of the characters
Mathilde,
named Mathilde, yeah.
Yeah, I know, and the weird thing was I had named her before I knew Mathilde, so it was kind of
Are you serious? Wow, that was kind of like
yeah,
a
coincidence. Oh, there were so many, you wouldn't believe all the coincidences. Like, I met this man who became, he's now my unofficially adopted son, and he came from the same town as, that's Mark Bizimana, and he came from the same town. I picked the town. I said, okay, Jean-Patrick, let's see. Okay, Cyangugu, that's in the south of Rwanda. It's near Burundi. So I said, okay, he comes from there. I'd at that time never been there. And, in fact, I don't – yeah, I guess I had been once to Rwanda. But so I picked Cyangugu. I made his uncle a fisherman, and I made him – you know, I made him so passionate about education. And then I meet this man who is the receptionist at the hotel. And when I see him, I do a double take because he looks exactly as I imagined Jean-Patrick. And then he tells me that he comes from Cyangugu and that his uncle's a fisherman and that he wants than anything to continue his education.
Did you, cry? I mean, did you,
I did.
That's just crazy. Like, I mean, I can't imagine standing there and having all that happen, like, flooding over you at once and then hearing his story. I mean, so it, you were meant to write the book then, in a sense, you know? You were meant to write the book. Also, you know, you talk a lot about your mother in the background of the book and her political activism based on her experience in the Holocaust. So what did she teach you as you were growing up that kind of pushed you into this social activism through your writing, but also you physically, I mean, I read that you were doing a lot of different volunteer work, but what specifically do you think your mother gave to you through her words or actions?
My mother was a red-haired fighter, and she grew up fighting, and she fought till the very end of her life. And she grew up in Eastern Europe. She was actually born on a horse-drawn carriage going from, she comes from, it's now in Romania, this village called Cernovich, and they were escaping the First World War when she was born, and they moved to Zurich. And in 1938, she was very active in anti-Nazi groups. Her father understood the danger of Hitler, and he was writing to his relatives who still lived in the area in Germany and Romania, that area, and he was saying, I can help you get out. Please let me help you get out. You don't understand the danger. And they all said, you know, don't worry about it. Hitler's crazy. No one takes him seriously. Our neighbors accept us. You know, we're secular Jews, and our neighbors accept us as human beings. So they didn't want to get out. But so my mother was active with this group where she would give her passport to this group, and they were getting Jews out of Germany with her passport. And I have her passport, and I know it's true because I can see all the stamps. It's spooky.
Wow.
And she was also, she was a communist. It's funny because her father was a businessman. And so my mother wanted to go fight against Franco in the Spanish Civil War. She's also a klutz. And my grandfather said to her, if you want Franco to win, go fight in the Spanish Civil War because you'll shoot all your friends.
Wow.
I mean, that's the kind of humor I grew up with. But, you know, so she was very active in communist organizations and anti-Nazi organizations. And then the Nazi ambassador came to Zurich. She lived in Zurich with her family, and the Nazi ambassador came. And my mother, with her bright red hair, she was very distinguishable and noticeable in
the
country.
You said she jumped on the she attacked him, but the car or something.
She jumped on the car and tore off the swastika.
So the Nazi
ambassador,
he had some big kahunas, so to speak.
Yes, she did. So my grandfather found out that, because he was well known in the community, and people approached him and said, you know, the Nazi ambassador is making trouble, and he wants to get your family deported back to Cernovich. So my grandfather decided to take his family and to leave. And unfortunately, I don't know exactly the story. I don't know how they went to Canada. And I know they sailed, but obviously they didn't sail from Zurich. So I don't know the story of their journey, how they got to the ship and how they got into Canada, because Canada has quotas on Jews. But so that's the kind
of person
that my... She was a fighter, and I grew up...
Yes.
You know, my mother took me to civil rights marches when I was a kid, and my mother was... I went to this really blue blood school, and it was used to be called Miss Windsor's Finishing School for Young Ladies. My mother fought to get me in because they didn't allow Jews. So she fought to get me in, you know. And then later she fought against the war in Vietnam. So I was brought up in, and of course McCarthy, some of my earliest memories or my parents listening to the TV and the radio, and I had this terrible fear. And, you know, all I knew was this, I had this vision of this monster named McCarthy, and I didn't know
coming
who
to maybe
he was.
Coming to your house or something? Or something,
yeah.
Something. Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
Do I have one small little story that I remember from my childhood? I didn't know what an FBI agent was, but this man, who I understood was very evil, came to our house. My mother was a psychiatrist, and she had a patient who was a very famous physicist, and he had come from an Eastern European country, and he had been a communist, and he had lied to get, he said he wasn't a communist, you know, because
right,
when you come into
the
United States, you have to, God forbid you should be a communist.
Well, that's similar to in your book, that the people had to lie, like Jean-Patrick had to lie about being a Hutu, and his coach gave him an opportunity, said, you know, hey,
right.
I want to give you this Hutu card, and he felt like, how can I do this? I'm abandoning my family, my culture, everything if I take this card. But for survival reasons, you know, he took the Hutu card, you know?
Right,
So people do all kinds of things to survive. We only have a couple minutes, but I do want to mention about gender warfare, though. Gender warfare is used in the book, and one of the main characters, Bea, I don't know how you pronounce her name,
Bea,
the love interest of Jean-Patrick, has to deal with that situation. She's raped and mutilated. Somehow she survives. But that is a very serious war tactic that wasn't used in the beginning of warfare, but it started being used. I think I was reading just historically about like World War I, people's different areas. This is a really serious problem because in this genocide, the Rwandan genocide, they really wanted to kill not only the present people but any future of the Tutsis. Talk to me when you interview people. What were they telling you? Just briefly, what stories were they?
I heard of, you know, people were raped and then got pregnant, and you know, it's like, how do you bring this baby into the world? Because it's your baby, but you know, it's a product of rape. And how do you bring a product of rape? And then now there's, you know, there's a terrible problem with HIV because many of the people, the women who were raped, the soldiers, a lot of them
had
HIV and AIDS, and they knew it. And that was a weapon. You know, I heard one story of a woman the man knew he was HIV positive. He knew he had AIDS. And he said, now I will give you a monster that will live with you forever. He didn't kill her, but he left her with that.
Yeah.
So you hear really horrible stories. But I mean, the good thing is that now there is Paul Farmer, Partners in Health, who started in Haiti. Now he has a lot of clinics in Rwanda. So there is a lot of effort now to treat people in Rwanda with the new drugs. So it's becoming less of a problem.
Yeah, it's still a serious problem, even here in America. I mean, I think people feel like now, well, if I get HIV/AIDS, I can live with it. But what they don't understand is that, you know, it has exacerbations like any other chronic illness, so to speak.
Right.
So, yeah, you can live with it, but you may have times where you're very sick, even though you can live longer. I mean, there are people living, you know, they're 60, they're 70, and they have HIV/AIDS for, you know, 20 years they've had it or something.
Yeah.
But it's not like it's going to be a happy life. So I've done many shows on HIV/AIDS and really talk about using protection, getting yourself tested, getting your partner tested, and things like that. But Naomi, thank you so much for coming on today. We could talk forever and ever. Running the Rift, I'll be giving some copies of your book away. And will you be speaking at a bookstore anywhere coming up, or talking about your book anywhere soon?
Well, let's see. I got two community reads. So in Portland, Oregon, which a suburb of Portland, Oregon, called Lake Oswego, the whole community is reading my book. I'm so excited about that. And they're having an 8K run in February. And, like, through January and February, they're having, like, all these events centered around my book. And I'll be speaking at the end of February there, and it's going to be filmed, so it'll be available. And then in April, actually right around the anniversary of the genocide, which is April 6th, I'll be in Naperville, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. And they also are having a run to coincide with my book. So I'm so excited about that. So those are
That's
the two
wonderful.
Big things.
Well,
and then I'll be
at the website.
Okay,
one more place. You're going to be where?
I'll be at the Tucson Festival of Books, too.
Okay. Well, let me tell them your website is Naomi, N-A-O-M-I, Benaron, B-E-N-A-R-O-N.com. And there you can check out reviews of her books, her other essays she's written, news articles, her appearance, and also contact her if you want to talk to her. And thank you so much for coming on today. Wonderful story. Again, I'll be giving away copies of the book. People can follow me on Twitter, at Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, send me an email. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. And if you're on Blog Talk Radio, you can leave comments under the show about, you know, what you thought about the interview. If you had any questions, please feel free to leave comments. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Thank you, Naomi, for coming on today.
Thanks so much. It was really a pleasure talking to you. You asked great questions.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. I hope you feel better. Naomi wasn't feeling too good, so I really want to say thank you again. And I hope your throat gets better soon.
Thanks. I'm on the mend.
So. Okay. Have a wonderful Saturday.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in again. I want to mention that you can check out her website, NaomiBenaron.com. Wonderful book. Let me just read you some of the quotes. Benaron accomplishes the improbable feat of wringing genuine loveliness from unspeakable horror. Running the Rift conveys so profoundly the joys of family, friendship, and community. That's Publishers Weekly. Author Barbara Kingsolver, truly fearless writing, culturally rich and completely engrossing. So you really want to check this book out. I'm going to give copies away, but you got to follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook in order to win a copy. Thank you so much for your support. Again, close to 500,000 downloads of the show. And I just want to say thank you. I hope you have a wonderful weekend, and I hope you continue to tune in. Thank you so much.